open house celebrating 50 years of KABU. There will be a reunion from 2 to 5 during the street party for folks looking to see KABU volunteers from other eras. So save the date, Saturday, August 11th, to celebrate 50 years of KABU with your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Onion Music Festival starting July 28th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space in Washougal, Washington. The Onion Music Festival features a three-day lineup of musicians, artists, installations, and vendors. Performers include the fabulous Downey Brothers, The Fur Coat, Night Heron, Adebisi, and many more. This is an 18 and over event with no dogs allowed. Again, that's the Onion Music Festival, July 28th and 29th at Sunnyside Outdoor Event Space, 30303 Northeast 10th Street in Washougal, Washington. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO programming is made possible by KABU member listeners and support from Portland Saturday Market, 4 or 5 years of handmade arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, and local music in downtown Portland, featuring live music and Kid Corner events. Portland Saturday Market, every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park, now through Christmas Eve. Every schedule, vendor information, and more online at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is poet, translator, novelist, essayist, and editor Forrest Gander. Gander has a degree in geology from the College of William and Mary and a master's degree in literature from San Francisco State University. And he's considered one of the leading practitioners today in the field of eco-poetics. His books of poetry include Science and Steepleflower, Torn Awake, Eye Against Eye, and Core Samples from the World, all out from New Directions. Core Samples from the World was both a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, and was described in a way that I think could also be a description of Gander's work at large, as being concerned with the way the self is revised and translated in encounters with the foreign. In this spirit, Forrest Gander's work frequently arises out of engagement and collaboration with the other and with others. He has worked with photographers, painters, dancers, glass and ceramic artists, and musicians, as well as many collaborations with other wordsmiths, co-writing with John Kinsella in the book Red Start and Ecological Poetics, co-editing with his partner, the poet C.D. Wright, at the small press Lost Roads Publishers, founded by Frank Stanford, and co-translating the works of the Bolivian poet Jaime Sáenz with Kent Johnson, to name a few. Gander's other translations include No Shelter, Selected Poems of Pura López Colomé, Alice Iris Red Horse, Selected Poems of Gozo Yoshimasu, and Then Come Back, The Lost Neruda Poems. Gander is also the editor of the anthologies Mouth to Mouth, Poems by 12 Contemporary Mexican Women, and Panic Cure, Poems from Spain in the 21st Century, among others. His awards include a Whiting Award, a Penn Translation Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, National Endowment of the Arts Fellowships, and 2 Gertrude Stein Awards in Innovative North American Poetry. Forrest Gander is the Adele Kellenberg Seaver Professor of Literary Arts and Comparative Literature at Brown University, and he's here today on Between the Covers to talk about his upcoming book of poetry from New Directions entitled Be With. Book Forum says the following about Gander's work. Forrest Gander is insistently, often gorgeously, a poet of space. The spaces of landscape and geology, the spaces of erotic and patrilineal bodies, and the spaces among and inside the words on the page of a poem. If Gander's philosophical strain and flamboyant lingo suggest Wallace Stevens, and his conversance with science and his stress on the ongoing, recall A.R. Ammons, he insinuates a naughty, K-N-O-T-T-Y, digressive intensity that is fully his own. The Colorado Review adds, "One answer to the way death constructs silence is to believe, as Gander does, that the soul is multilingual in the same tongue. His trinity of natural science, spirit, and language tempts us to believe it's so." And finally, the critic and poet Craig Morgan Teicher, in his review of Gander's forthcoming collection Be With for NPR, says, "Forrest Gander's life partner, the poet C.D. Wright, died suddenly a little more than 2 years ago, and this book is one result or record of the aftermath of that loss. In poems that are utterly naked and bereft, elegies, apologies, could have beens, Gander grieves and wonders about what's left in his life. There is so much pain in this book, perhaps too much, almost too much, but what is poetry for if not for this? And there's more life in one of these dark words than in most entire books. Reading this book may hurt, but it will help people to keep living through what they thought they could never survive." Welcome to Between the Covers, Forrest Gander.
Thank you, David. I'm glad to be between the covers with you.
Well, that line of Craig's, that there's so much pain in the book, perhaps too much, almost too much, but what is poetry for if not for this? It mirrors my experience of encountering this work. When I read the poems, I have a strong impulse not to speak afterwards, to be silent, or more accurately, I feel struck speechless by them. And it made me wonder how to begin the interview. And if I were to follow that impulse, I would just have you read poems and then play silence for 10 minutes after each poem. But then I thought, you've made me feel this sense of being robbed of speech, using words and using language. And the mystery of that seems like as good a place to start as any. When you look at the first third of the collection, Be With, you see that your early poems seem to be pointing to this mystery between silence and language and the relationship to the unspeakable. In Carbonized Forest, you have the line, "Here is the untranslation of the world." In Epitaph, "A deaf translation, and the script must remain hidden." In Beckoned, the line, "Grief sounds ricocheted outside of language." And in Entenderment, you reference a 4th century Chinese reversible poem that can be read 7,000 different ways, and I would suspect is one of the most untranslatable poems in the world. And in the first poem, near the very beginning of the first poem, you ask, "Why say anything about death?" So talk to us a little bit about this mystery between language and the unsayable and the untranslatable in Be With.
For one thing, I think that poems are very involved with silence. That's often what scares people away from poems. And that it's sort of miraculous that in this age, this epoch of the spectacle, that people can still encounter the silence of poems on the page in a room alone and be transformed and have those harrow their souls. That seems like one of the miraculous powers of poetry. And with grief is, you know, this abyss that sucks all energy. You look into the abyss and nothing comes back from it. And to write into it is to write into a profound silence. it reminds me. There's a great poem by a great Mexican poet named Jaime Sabines. I included in an anthology of essential Latin American poems called Pinholes in the Night. Jaime Sabines writes a long poem of grief for his father upon his death, something about the death of Major Sabines, which is the translation in English. And it's a while after his father's death before he writes it, and then this poem, it's a two-part, very long poem, it just you know, just gushes out of him. Because I think it's almost like when poets are sick with grief, they vomit, and the vomit is a gush of words. And he says in that poem, he says, maldito el que crea que este es un poema, you know, like, you know, damn it if anyone thinks this is a poem, because it's not a poem in some sense. It's something that has just come out of him that he doesn't want to shape, that he doesn't want to turn into art or something pretty, because of how raw it is. And part of that rawness is the silence that comes out with it.
Do you think that the silence is invited in through how one modulates specificity? I feel like you sort of turn the limits of language into one of its strengths in this collection. There's this great specificity in image and emotion and circumstance, but then a pulling back of specificity at times, like when I think of the titles, What It Sounds Like or Tell Them No, what the it and the them are referring to, or the mystery of the title of the collection, Be With, which implies the question, be with what? And that what seems to keep changing and becoming more complex as you move farther into the book.
Yeah. The be with comes directly from a poem of C.D. Wright's, but what you say about that is really important to me, because I think the self is only constructed in relationship, which is what's so hard about losing someone who you've been in a relationship with for a very long time, is that your self is a mutuality. It's a collaboration at some point, and to be cut off from that is profoundly disturbing. So that's in something like Be With, and not naming the agency that would be with you, it does leave that open, because I think we are not just a collaboration of engagement with a single person, but with a landscape, with a world, with everything that those terms of what we interact with and how we're changed and made in those interactions is multiple.
Well, the collection opens with an epigram by the poet William Bronk, and I was hoping you would read it before we talked about him. It's a poem in its entirety, I believe, the world.
It is. I love William Bronk. You sent me a little email implying that you knew him too. He's a poet who isn't read so much, but is for me as almost as important as Wallace Stevens, whose voice he can sometimes sound like. This is William Bronk's. I invited William Bronk to come read at Brown University early in my time there, and he just didn't travel anymore for readings. But his recorded readings are fantastic. Mm. I thought you were an anchor in the drift of the world, but no, there isn't an anchor anywhere. There isn't an anchor in the drift of the world. Oh no, I thought you were, oh no, the drift of the world.
This isn't the first time your poetry is engaged with his work. He has a two-line poem called Compensation that goes, to live without solace is possible because solace is trivial, none is enough. And you use that line, to live without solace, as the title of a poem in an earlier collection. So I was just wondering if maybe you could expand a little bit about what about Bronk attracts you.
I love your deep reading, David. For one thing, Bronk's relationship to silence, the silence in his poems, one feels very strongly. And his kind of severe ethical stance, that his poems are very much about an ethics of being, and one that isn't one that has a kind of severity about an honesty about it. For instance, in the lines that you just read, that, you know, people tell people who are grieving that things will be better, that they will get over this, that there's some solace, and yet no solace. The truth is that things can't ever be normal again, that even the desire for normality is a kind of depraved, monstrous desire. And Bronk is honest with that and with his with how he writes about life and death.
Well, I mean, this is one of the great pleasures of preparing for this interview, was discovering him, actually. So my email to you gave you a false impression that I have a long history with him, but I only had encountered him in any significant way as a cameo in Ben Lerner's novel, 1004, where he plays a small role. But in investigating him further, I found all these articles wondering why he's not more read, philosophizing on it, and also looking at his thoughts on language's relationship to reality that felt very resonant with some of the questions we're raising, and even some of the questions that I hope to discuss later about eco-poetics. But there's this poem of his, Miscalling, that goes, "Everyday things, work, people, in fact, are real. We sometimes ask if they are. They are. They're not what we call them, though, but something else, and not such that we can ever know." And the Literary Review, where that they restated that poem, goes on to surmise that for Bronk, poetry is about what exists independent of writing. It's about that something, that force, which sweeps poetry and everything else away. Does that resonate with you?
It does. It does. And then this, you know, the strange complementary part of that is that all we have is language to try to reach that with, and to express that with, to offer it to other people with.
Would you be willing to read Beckoned for us?
Sure. Beckoned. At which point my grief sounds ricocheted outside of language, something like a drifting swarm of bees. At which point in the tetric silence that followed, I was swarmed by those bees and lost consciousness. At which point there was no way out for me either. At which point I carried on in a semi-coma, dreaming I was awake, avoiding friends and puking, plucking stingers from my face and arms. At which point her voice was pinned to a backdrop of vaporous color. At which point the crane's bustles flared. At which point, coming to, I knew I'd pay the whole flagpole fare. At which point the driver turned and said, "It doesn't need to be your fault for it to break you." At which point, without any lurching commencement, he began to play a vulture bone flute. At which point I grew old, and it was like ripping open the beehive with my hands again. At which point I conceived a realm more real than life. At which point there was at least some possibility. Some possibility in which I didn't believe, of being with her once more.
We've been listening to Forrest Gander read from his upcoming collection, Be With. This may be the poem I come back to the most in the collection, and I wanted to use it as an entryway into questions I have about marrying an eco-poetic approach to art with a subject that is intensely personal, interior, and subjective. In Red Start, you and John Kinsella lay out some of the defining characteristics of an eco-poetic approach, and they include a dispersal of ego-centered agency, a stance of self-reflexivity, where the poem does not originate in the self, but within the landscape to which it is given back, a rejection of any attempt to gather the world into some kind of unity and permanence in favor of an encounter with the world marked by what you call entropic fluctuations, among many other defining characteristics. But this poem, and many of the poems in the collection, take an emotion, grief, that feels so deeply rooted in individual selfhood and creates a language of otherhood to express it. And I'd love it if you could speak to that a little bit for us.
I'm not sure that I can, that I'm far enough away from these poems to be able to do that. I know that I haven't written poems in the way these poems came to me since I was a teenager, where these just gushed out of me, and I didn't have an audience in mind. I didn't even have expression in mind. I just, because I've lived in poetry for almost all of my life, that's the form of my response to the world. But I think that grief is something that everyone has in them, that even the grief of the imagination of their own mortality, of their aging, of all the things that we lose, that we manage to keep a rein on to live normal lives, but that when someone speaks of grief, it reaches something that all of us have, a cord that's deep in everyone's solar plexus.
Well, one of the things this one poem beckoned reminded me of was a story that Ricky Ducournay tells in one of her essay collections. It's about one of her first memories. She's learning the alphabet in a picture book, and each page is A is for apple and B is for bee. And she's reading in the grass, and she sits on a bee by accident and is stung. And this is a revelation, because it somehow collapses the distance between the signifier and the thing, that B is for B, but B is also B at the same time. And I wondered about your thoughts on language in regards to our relationship to the non-human other. On the one hand, I think of language like a scrim across reality. For instance, when William Bronk says, "Landscape is metaphor and only metaphor, but oh, I have loved it so." But on the other hand, I think of this Ducournay experience, and I find it very attractive. And also, I'm going to read a little snippet of something that C.D. said that feels kindred to the Ducournay experience also. She said, "Writing for me is a thing delicate as love, and in love one struggles to be a newborn, to be without attributes, like snow nobody has walked on, prelapsarian, also to be mutable like a river. Thus, with one rivery flow of words after another, I write, to rise above one's own failures, to wrest hope from the next disappointment, to feel clarity and happiness, the great rush to participate in the odyssey of language, to take up the leaky pen of a long life, to lie down with our rich friend silt. In writing, bad thoughts and feelings slither away one by one. This is my breviary." In those words, I feel language is a portal, not a scrim, a portal toward fellowship that is, or can be, our almost like our bird song, our most natural and vital of sounds as humans. So I wanted to just throw that weird conundrum back in your court and hear your thoughts on that.
Well, between you and CD, that was so beautifully expressed. I think that the shift in, to connect it to eco-poetics or just to the 21st century, that our sense of being in control of everything, of that God said, "Go master the earth, master the creatures of the earth," we don't believe in that sense anymore. And that language, which has been used as a very logocentric way of controlling our view of the world and of taking possession of the world, you know, the subject through the verb controls the object. A lot of us don't believe that's a very healthy way to live in the world, and that that kind of attitude towards towards being leads to terrible things. And so that sense that you're talking about also of, I mean, we don't control, we're born into a language that precedes us and that helps shape our mind, just as we're born into an environment that does that. And language is an environment, it's part of an environment that shapes us. And so what CD is saying, and I think what you are too, and what John and I are saying in the book about ecopoetics, is that poetry can happen as like a jazz improvisation, that you don't come to it with answers. You come to it with questions, responsiveness, whatever talents you have, but that are engaged in a tremendous listening into that otherness. And it's that back and forth, the livingness of that back and forth, that can make a poem that's maybe more adequate to our needs.
I was hoping you could follow that with you reading First Ballad, A Wreath, which feels like it evokes the sense of languages as communion.
Thanks for having me read this poem. This poem is started out as a translation of a poem by Juan de Yepes, who's better known as Saint John of the Cross, and then became transformed after CD's death. And it's the most unlike all the other poems in the book, and in some sense the most abstract. And I'm hoping that it works partly because of the way the rhythm and the caesura in it worked. There's a caesura all down the middle of the poem, which is this absence that the two sides are reaching across. And that also seems connected to grief, which is this wound. The, you know, the technical word for what happens when skin from one side of a wound reaches the skin from the other side of the wound, to close off the wound, that's called creep. And I think there are wounds that are so profound that they don't heal, that caesura stays there, and that the call back and forth across that chasm is all there can be. First Ballad, A Wreath, after St. John of the Cross. In the beginning the Word was as being, in happiness, infinitely the Word possessed. The same Word being was, said to be beginning, beginninglessly it went on, a sum caroming through fervid void, for the Word from the outset always was conceiving, concentrating its consequence, for glory in the Word possessed the being, and all of being's substance it gleaned from the Word, lover in beloved in the other one went on, and that love which entwined them was of the same sum, two voices, one beloved among two, and in them each one happiness rendered them one lover, a splendor unconfessed, gleaming, as two possess one being, each alone possessed it, each of them in love, a plenum of the Word, whose being each twined around the other, beyond comprehension, an ineffable knot, such fervid love, entwined the two together, in one voice both possessed, a plenum of the world. The more that love was one, the more of love there was.
We've been listening to Forrest Gander read from his upcoming collection, Be With. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Forrest.
Thanks a lot, David, for your wonderful, deep intelligence and for your reading and poetry.
We were talking today to poet and translator Forrest Gander about his upcoming book, Be With, from New Directions. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center in Portland. The Rosewood Health Fair will provide health and wellness resources to the community, along with sports, physicals, and immunizations for children. There will be food, games, prizes, and a variety of community resources for families. Again, that's Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center, 8935 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found on the kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the film show. I'm S.W. Conser, and I'm joined right now by the celebrated director behind such independent films as Drugstore Cowboy, My Own Private Idaho,